Dr. Jesse Davis, welcome to Winning with Data.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Thanks for your time today. You are one of the world's leading researchers on sports analytics. Why did you get into it? What makes it unique? And what are some of the biggest challenges from a technical and data modeling standpoint?
Yeah, so I've always been interested in sports ever since I was a kid. I mean, we always had season college basketball tickets and then football tickets when I was growing up. And I swam competitively through my first year of college. So it's always been something that I've been extremely interested in. And I never thought about doing it as part of my work until I became a professor. And there were a number of students when I started here in Leuven that were also interested in sports. So people like Jan van Aden, who was interested in soccer. And there were two other people, Joris Renkens and Albrecht Zimmermann, who were very interested in basketball. And there was kind of a critical mass, and we started working in the area. I think it's a great problem from an AI perspective because it touches on basically every big AI problem. It's, you know, decision-making, representations, learning. So it's a really fascinating spatial temporal data. So it's a really fascinating area to work in.
So most of your sports analytics research is in soccer. How does the low-scoring nature of the game impacting in how difficult it is to tackle some of these problems that you mentioned?
Yeah, it makes it extremely difficult. I mean, it's a sport where the signal is extremely sparse. So it doesn't really matter if you're looking at tactics or rating players or any of these things. I mean, it's hard to kind of pick up on what's going on in the data because there's a lot of things that people are doing that might have a payoff, but it's very far down the line, or it only has a payoff, you know, once every 30, 40 times that they do it. And it makes it much more challenging to try to think about how to find the relevant patterns in the data.
Every sport thinks that it's unique and that problems from other sports might not apply. I'm an optimist there. What can sports besides soccer learn from some of your research and the research around the field?
I think there's two parts. When you talk about sports analytics, I think people talk often about the technical stuff that happens during the match. I think there's a lot of stuff on the physical side that people do. I think that's less well known within the machine learning literature. And things like running are common to a lot of sports. So I think that the things that people learn about load management and all this stuff are definitely applicable across sports. And then I think at a high level, it's interesting. I mean, I think if you look at things like action value of systems, I mean, the stuff that's used in hockey, ice hockey, basketball, soccer, rugby is all derivative. It's all basically the same thing with some small domain adaptations. So I think there is a lot of crossover in this sense. I think there's a higher level connection between sports. I mean, also in terms of tactics, I think a lot of tactics and things like, well, basketball, soccer, American football, it's about how to exploit time and space. You know, how to make opponents feel like they're rushed, how to create space. And I think those are kind of universal concepts in a lot of these sports.
So touching back on soccer specifically, the expected goals metric has become very mainstream now. We see it in television broadcasts. It's even present in the FIFA game, video game. And moving to one of your most cited and well-known works, the VAPE framework. So I wanted for you to briefly explain what the expected goals metric is. What is the VAPE framework? How you went about extending the notion of valuing certain actions players perform during the game?
Yeah, so the idea behind expected goals is to try to come up with a way to value scoring opportunities. And typically how this works is that they're trying to compute the probability that a shot will result in a goal. And this is great because goals are very random. They're subject to things like deflections, and expected goals is really telling you how often do players get in good shooting positions. Of course, it helps in the fact that shots are more frequent than goals, but still the number of shots in a match is a small fraction of the number of actions. So you're really missing out on a lot of things, and as well as context. And so because of that, we were really driven to try to see if we could come up with a way to value all the on-the-ball actions that were happening in the match. And this is something that we actually started on quite a while ago. So we started in 2016 was our first attempt to do this. There's a little-known precursor that was based on a completely different approach, but it did value all offensive actions. So it really kind of went beyond XG's in this sense. And we quickly kind of moved on from that and came up with the idea of VAPE. The idea behind VAPE is we try to assign a value to every action, which effectively measures how each action contributes to the match's score differential. So we looked at two things, the probability of scoring, say in the next 10 to 15 actions or 10 to 15 seconds, as well as the risk. So the chance of conceding in the next 10 to 15 actions or for 10 to 15 seconds. This allowed us, framing it in this way, allowed us to use some more complicated machine learning models to estimate these probabilities from data. This was actually very hard to get published. I think it was submitted 4 times before it ended up getting accepted, surprisingly enough.
Yeah, and it ended up winning the KDD Applied Data Science Best Paper Award, so I guess...
Only after they rejected it the previous year.
So as a follow-up, could you go about how teams can make use of these estimates from the VAPE framework to enhance their recruiting process?
Yeah, I think it's really about helping provide additional context. I think it could be useful in a couple of different ways. So one, there are thousands of players or tens of thousands of players that you might be interested in looking at, and you simply don't have time to look at everyone and to look at video and to do a deep dive. So I think it's useful in coming up with a short list. I think another use case is it can help contextualize what you see in the video. So if your scout sees 2 or 3 games or even 1 game, I mean, did they have their best game? Did they have their worst game? These types of things that might just provide a little bit extra context that you can consider when looking at a player. It's just another piece of information that's like, another small puzzle piece that completes the overall picture that a team would have in a player.
Something elusive that teams are working on that data science can help them with is a distinct playing style and an identity that can guide player transfers, but also even outlast managers. This can sometimes be challenging when looking at different leagues and even players that might fit their style that are not currently playing in the style that they're hoping to play in. What are some approaches that you think teams can take? And what do you think kind of the next level or the next frontier of this type of research is?
So I think making sure that a player fits in a team's style of play is a really important question. It's actually something that we've been interested in for quite a long time. And it's one of the areas that, I guess, a theme that has been running through our group for the last 3 to 5 years. We actually started off with something pretty basic here, and we were trying to capture the relationship between where on the pitch certain players do certain actions. And this initial idea really just looked at a very small number of offensive actions like shooting, dribbling, and passing. I think this gives part of the picture. We quickly came to realize that this was very limited in a couple of ways. So if you think about different playing styles, you can look at, say, someone like Trent Alexander-Arnold or Kyle Walker. They're both right backs, but they play very differently. And if you look at their pass maps, Kyle Walker would tend to play much more conservatively, many more lateral passes or backwards passes, whereas Alexander-Arnold is really kind of pinging the ball across field far. And this led us to realize that there were other things such as like the directionality and the distance of how long these passes are. And we started to move into kind of more complicated ways to try to measure these and to capture these. I think we're really not there yet in that we've really been looking at style from on the ball actions. I mean, I think one interesting thing to look at is what can happen off the ball. I mean, I know that's something that Hugo and I have spent a lot of time talking about over the last year. I think we're close, but don't yet have a satisfying answer there. I think also coming up with kind of reoccurring patterns of play and what kind of patterns of play people are and aren't able to do, and some things to do with decision making are also really interesting, but not yet really explored in this space.
Yeah. Just following up on the same topic, how different is it to evaluate players versus to capture the playing style of players? I know this is something that oftentimes gets mixed up and people end up using metrics and things that are related to actual skill rather than style. What would be a good definition to differentiate the two?
I mean, I guess the technical answer is typically when you're rating players, you're doing some sort of predictive modeling. I mean, everything is based on sort of making predictions or modeling the chances of scoring. The playing style is much more of a needle in the haystack question. It's more pattern mining. It's trying to find patterns in the data. And it's harder to come up with what to look for. So you really need to think about more clever ways either to guide what you're looking for based on domain knowledge or to kind of cleverly elicit information from domain experts about what is and is not relevant. I think that makes it much more challenging.
So your research in sports analytics has attracted lots of attention from practitioners, fans, even the media in some very famous outlets such as 538, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, ESPN, and The Athletic. So what is the key to sharing these technical and quantitative findings that sometimes aren't straightforward for a non-technical audience for them to understand the concepts in a clear way?
I think one thing that's probably pretty underrated is it's important to have a good question. So you have to come up with a question that people are interested in knowing the answer to. So if I invent a question that only I'm interested in, then no one is going to be interested in it. So I think a lot of time and thought has to go in coming up with a good question. I think the second thing is really focusing on telling a story that people can relate to. I mean, and in a way that they can relate. So you have to avoid the technicalities. You have to think about how we try to spend a lot of time looking at video and images, and how can we convey our ideas in video and images or through interactive demos. I think those are really important. Simple ideas are also a lot easier to convey than more complex things. So any way that you can kind of simplify an idea and get to its core essence really helps.
Yeah, and your lab has some really awesome work in sharing the research you developed in simple and effective ways via interactive visualizations, which oftentimes is something that's not very common in the space.
Yeah, that's all Peter. Peter's great at that.
I think you touched on something really interesting there, where knowing how to ask the right question is just so crucial to getting what you need from a data set. And obviously, they're the subject matter experts. Executives and teams know what they want to achieve, but they don't know how to interrogate data to get there. How have you learned how to ask the right questions?
I think it's been a lot of learning. I mean, I think this is an area where we've actually been working on for over 10 years. So we've had a lot of experience asking the wrong questions, not doing those things. I mean, when you know, the longer you work in it, the more access you get to domain experts, the more you get to interact with them, the more that you find out what they're interested in. But it's really a process of building trust, of learning how to communicate with each other, understanding the language they use, and all these things. And it can be very different. I mean, we've done a lot of work also on the physical side. That's actually kind of where we initially were working before we moved to the more technical analysis from the matches. I mean, I guess we're still very active in areas like running, but it's been a long process, and you have to have great collaborators and people that are willing to work with you and teach you so that you can learn to communicate with each other.
Are there any themes among good questions that you ask?
That's a good question. I don't know that I see any immediate themes to what we've asked. I mean, I think starting in a field earlier gives you an advantage, is that there are a lot of easy questions to ask. I mean, I think there are a lot of obvious things. There's the low-hanging fruit. I think we're past the point in soccer, at least, where there's a lot of low-hanging fruit left. So now you really have to be creative, and it just takes a lot of time.
It is constantly elusive when people try to figure out what will help a player transfer into a league successfully. What makes a midfielder in Portugal likely to succeed in the Premier League? And you see Bernardo Silva looking physically not a fit for such a physical league, but he's a superstar. How do you evaluate physical metrics of players that might indicate how they may or may not perform in certain leagues that are very, and I'm using air quotes here, physical?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is where things like broadcast tracking will probably be more important, where you can get some physical metrics and see. One thing that we've looked at, which was a very simple idea, which is something I did with Walter Branson, is we simply looked at the timestamps on events and looked at how often do you typically have on the ball. If I receive a pass, how long does it take before I play the next action? And you can see, if you look at this, you know, the Champions League, the time between actions is much shorter than it is in some of the other leagues. You know, the Premier League also has this. So the distributions can vary widely because, you know, sometimes you can have a lot of time, the team isn't pressing you. But on average, you can see that there's a step up, and you can try to look at then things like this. Are they able to kind of execute these actions in a shorter amount of time like you would in a more physical league where there's probably less time and space to do something?
What are your recommendations to allow research to be implemented at clubs? How can you make your research have an impact in practice, as you guys have lots of GitHub repositories and materials for people that want to reproduce your research?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I mean, I think there are a couple of ways. So we have open sourced a lot of our stuff to allow people to benefit from it. I think this is a great thing to do from an academic perspective. It's important that people can see what you've done, that they can learn from it. You don't want people to waste time reinventing the wheel for 5 years. I think it slows everything down. And if you do it and the software is good, which takes a lot of time to get it right, that can have a pretty big impact. I mean, I can tell you that moving into production makes things a lot more difficult. I mean, we have a spinoff that's focused on physical therapy and rehabilitation called Run Easy, where we do kind of real-time biomechanical analyses from running injuries, where we also have worked with some sports clubs and teams and soccer and in field hockey and things like this. And that's like really hard. I mean, there's a lot more that you have to get right then. That's another way to have impact is to do something like that. But it is a really big step from an academic prototype, even from what I think is the very good code that we put online, to actually having something that's usable in practice by a team. And I think that's a place where, you know, like a company like you guys is really important, where you can help people actually implement this in practice. I mean, as an academic institution, we're not really set up to offer continuous support and things like this on a basis. And this is like, I think, a really important thing that's missing.
It's rare that I've seen a professor talk about or expressed interest in automated machine learning and associated technologies. Can you tell us what your exposure is to that, if you use it, why you're interested in it, and what you believe the value proposition might be?
Yeah, so I'm extremely interested in it. And the reason I'm actually interested in it is because of sports and because of the physical side. And it comes from all the signal processing stuff that we did. So we were constantly working, you know, it was whether it was from, you know, the GNSs on the athletes, whether it's accelerometer or IMUs that we were putting on people, activity recognition for people that needed hip and knee replacements. But we found that we were spending months kind of doing the same task over and over and over again in terms of process, you know, filtering the signals, constructing new signals, dealing with orientations, extracting features, and all this stuff. And it was painful, and it really kind of inspired us to look into how we could automate some of these processes in order to essentially save time. Right. We saw that our colleagues in sports science were spending months doing this, and we saw really kind of a gap there. And we produced some tools that were really focused on automated feature construction. And I think that's been really valuable for us. It's made us be able to do things a lot faster and a lot simpler. And it's also been useful. The sports scientists here are using them in master theses and PhD theses, and it's also made them much more efficient.
I want to dig into that a little further because I love that explanation. How have you thought about shifting the way you look at the process of building a data model or a modeling project from really thinking about the model and fine-tuning it by hand to worrying less about which model you're using and more about the outputs?
Yeah, maybe I shouldn't say this as a machine learner, but like, I think for me, what I've learned is as you go more towards practice, I think, yeah, the model matters much less than one would think. It's really about, one, do you have really good features? Do you have really good data? And do you know exactly what it is that you want to kind of want to model? And if you can get those things right, there's like a handful of models that are going to work really well. I mean, if you go back to the AutoML thing, so I guess what most people think about in automated machine learning is configuring the model. So selecting the model and selecting the hyperparameters. And if you actually talk to the guys that have done this, basically they say, well, you could just use gradient boosted trees and that would be fine. But there's no reason to have the other stuff in there per se. I might disagree a little bit. Sometimes I think logistic regression is good or nearest neighbors, but you know, I think that's not far off that, you know, get the features right. And if you pick a tree ensemble, you're probably going to get pretty close to state of the art on whatever task you're looking at.
I just find getting a good answer quickly to a stakeholder matters a lot more than getting a great answer 3 days after it would have made a difference.
Yes. There's a lot of reasons why in practice going fast is important or keeping it simple is also important. You're a lot less likely to make a mistake with a simple solution than something that is overly complex.
So on another topic, as a professor, you're probably aware of some of the most common mistakes people make when building machine learning models, especially those that are just starting out. What are some of these most common mistakes, and what questions should people ask themselves in a way that they can investigate their modeling approach and ensure that what they're building is reliable?
I think that's a great question. It's something we've actually submitted a paper on recently, which was an extension of a WorkPuck paper, which is on like how to evaluate sports analytic models. So this is something that I think is really hard, and there are a lot of mistakes that people make here in terms of things like data leakage between training and test sets and stuff like this. I think there's also a lot of kind of pre-processing tricks that people aren't aware of in terms of future transformations beyond the standard z-normalization or min-max scaling or things like this, how to account for different contexts, how to deal with temporal data. I think these are all really, really common mistakes that people make. I think another common mistake is, yeah, like trying to go for immediately an incredibly complicated solution. I think in this regard, there's a brilliant talk by Killian Weinberger on deconstructing ML, and he goes through like three different projects where they did an overly complicated thing and stripped it back to something that was extremely simple that worked really well. So I would tell people to keep it simple as well.
I am fascinated in how long it takes research to be implemented in practice, and I watched this in sports science for a decade. Vape is used all around the world, so that's a great example of something being translated and implemented very quickly. What are the obstacles to every club implementing everything you've published, and how can they solve for that?
I think one big obstacle is you need to have someone dedicated to doing it. I think if you're only going to have one or two people working on analytics, it's really not going to be possible because there are so many really important things that they need to do on a day-to-day basis to keep their processing running, to keep recruiting going, to keep, you know, game match preparation running smoothly. So there's a lot about kind of the long-term perspective as well. You can't kind of have these long-running projects that may or may not pay off or might pay off in the future. I mean, I think this is, again, like a place where a company like you is going to be helpful and that you can kind of take on some of this burden. It's hard to do if you're just one person trying to run all the analytics, or even two people.
Dr. Jesse Davis, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me. It was really interesting to talk to you too.